Welcome to Musical Progression, the podcast where I interview professional musicians to try to find out how to get from point A of an emerging artist to point fully evolved professional. This week's guest is superstar composer Tarek O'Regan. Tarek is a British and American composer. His most recent major projects are Matahari, a full-length ballet for the Dutch National Ballet, and The Phoenix, an opera about the life of Lorenzo da Ponte, starring Thomas Hampson and Luca Pizzaroni, commissioned by the Houston Grand Opera. He is currently working on a saxophone concerto for Amy Dixon, which will be premiered at the Pristine Festival during his tenure as composer in residence there. And now on with the podcast. So let's go ahead and start at the beginning. What successes and setbacks did you experience as a university student? How did those experiences lead you to where you are today? Did you win prizes? Were you published during the university years? How did that go?
I mean, my university experience, which was at Oxford University, and I was at Pembroke College in Oxford. So the thing about Pembroke College in my case was, you know, there are very, very few music students. In fact, there was one other music student in my year. So over 3 years, I think there were, you know, maximum of six music students in the
really
entire
tight
college.
Group.
Yeah, very much so. And I think to begin with, you are a little bit at sea in a sense, because the people that you're, you know, friends with fundamentally and that you're spending more time with in the college are people studying other subjects. But I think actually in hindsight, that was a very beneficial thing for me, which was to see and witness the creative arts in the broader context of a wider humanity, which is to not be in the bubble of a bespoke institution such as a music conservatoire. So that was one of those things where it was quite hard in a sense, because, you know, people studying politics or economics, you know, they might enjoy music, but, you know, conversations about 15th century polyphony,
A favorite topic,
yeah, didn't go very far. So I think that sense of being a small cog in a big machine was quite difficult, but actually very positive in the long run. And the other thing about Oxford then, and this may very well not be the case now, is it was primarily not an institution with a focus on composing or performing. Mm-hmm. Really, it was an institution of the academic study of music, which fundamentally meant history.
So a bunch of research as opposed to composing and performing.
Yeah. And again, this is a prime example of something that was very difficult for me, because by that point, I had become more and more interested in composing. But the bulk of my time in terms of studying music was studying history of music and studying analysis and studying keyboard harmony and studying techniques of composition, as they called it, which really is the understanding of counterpoint and harmony. And so, you know, that felt quite difficult as well. But I think, again, later in life, I've drawn upon those things in very, very strong ways, which I suppose is all to say the things that you end up benefiting from later in life, you, at the time that you are going through those things, they you may not realize. And in fact, they may feel antithetical. You know, there was a point I was thinking, you know, I got really into student politics. I was sort of I became president of the what they call the these colleges is called the junior common room, but basically the student union. Mm-hmm. And you know, the bulk of my time was being spent on student politics, and when I was interacting with the music department, the bulk of my time was being spent on history. And I, you know, I very much felt this is about as far away from composing as you can get.
Yeah.
But again, you know, all of those things, I mean, especially, you know, the ability to communicate with lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds and to try and make persuasive arguments with regard to your opinions and trying to rally people on side. has been extremely beneficial with the sort of the business side, I suppose, of a career in the music world. It was quite hard in that way, but it was a fundamentally hugely enjoyable experience, and I just progressed further and further away from music. Right at the end of my time, so the degree then was 3 years, we're talking about 1996 to 1999. I decided that I didn't want to go into music at all. By the end of my second year. So this was at the peak of sort of being JCR president, not really engaging very strongly with the music department, and feeling quite disconnected from music as a whole. I decided that I was going to go and work in what the Brits called the city, which in US parlance would be Wall Street.
Oh.
So I went and worked for JP Morgan, the bank. This was before it had merged with Chase Manhattan to become JP Morgan Chase. So I did that as a summer intern, and I worked in big long holiday periods in the UK. So I think I worked there for sort of 3 months. Came back for my final year, and I thought, well, this is it. I'll do my exams, I'll get my degree, and that's going to be my career. What happened at the end of my period of study was I sent some pieces in for a competition, and these were choral pieces, and they won some prizes. And that was the sort of thing that began to open some doors. So, I mean, I ought to preface that by saying that I ended up writing choral music at Oxford because the focus, as I said, was primarily on the history of music. Mm. And so the level of performance, with notable exceptions, but the level of performance was not very high with regard to instrumental music. And, you know, one of the things that I've come to realize is that when you begin writing music as a composer, you ironically need very good performances of your work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that something that I've thought of a lot, which is that when you, at the point that you don't know exactly what you're doing, that's when you need great performance, so that when you hear something that doesn't sound right, you know why it doesn't sound right, and it's not because the people performing it didn't perform it correctly, it's because there's something in your writing that hasn't quite matched what was in your head. So the one area of music making that was extremely high quality was in the choral foundations in Oxford, which are attached and part of some of these colleges, so specifically Magdalen College, New College, and Christchurch College. And now there are many, many more. They're always happening, they sort of come in and out of focus, but there's a great, great amount of fantastic singing in choruses. So I started writing for New College Choir, Edward Higginbottom, because they were very open to the idea of new music. And also, they gave really great performances of the work, primarily during the, you know, 6-7 times a week evensong service.
Mm-hmm.
So it was through writing for them and getting good recordings and honing my skill as a composer in that way that I was able to acquire, you know, a small number of pieces with some good quality recordings. And that's what I sent off to these competitions in my final year or so, and I sort of forgotten about it and was all set to go and become an investment banker when they won these prizes. And what that did was get the interest of publishers, music publishers. And music publishing is very hard because you'd think it might be the way that, you know, A&R used to work at record labels, which is you'd go and scout bands,
right,
you know, in small clubs, and you know someone from the label would see a small band and think, this band's got something, I'm going to sign them to a deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, classical music publishing doesn't really work that way. It partly because there isn't there's not enough people in the industry working to go and do that. And secondly, it's a very slow business. There are not thousands and thousands and thousands of the equivalent of bands with concerts every night.
Right.
You know, there may be thousands and thousands of composers, but a very small fraction of them are getting their works performed by, let's say, a symphony orchestra. So the ability for a publisher to, the equivalent of a classical music publisher going to the small club, seeing a band that they want to sign.
Right, so...
is statistically very hard.
Yeah, and well, and here you are. You're published, I believe, exclusively through Novello, which is one of the big publishers in the world. Did you start with Novello because of these prizes, or how did you get them to notice you and like you enough that they wanted to sign you to publish everything that you write? That's so, for a lot of young composers, that's the dream.
So I would say that we live in a sort of market economy. So music publishing is no different to that. Mm-hmm. And what tends to happen is there is a sequence of events whereby you gradually get to the attention of the publisher that you want to be with. So, you know, my rough journey went something like, I won these prizes. A Finnish publisher picked up my first works. This is a company called Sulasol. They publish quite a lot of work, really interesting stuff. And they picked up a few pieces. And then that is what brought me to the attention of Oxford University Press. And this goes back to the A&R rock band in the club.
Right.
You know, the way that you get attention to a music publisher is probably from another music publisher, which is probably from another music publisher, which is probably from a prize. So it's not because you've written a really good work and sent it in.
That
way of thinking doesn't happen.
So it's more of climbing up a ladder. If you get a small publisher's attention, and then a larger one will get you, and then...
Or something in the business that brings you some kind of external vetting. No doubt someone listening to this is going to say, well, I sent my piece to a publisher on spec and it was published. There are always going to be exceptions, but I'm talking about 99.999999% of, you know, material that ends up being published in this way, where you have an exclusive relationship with the publisher, is not by sending in material on spec. There may be examples of someone sending a piece to a publisher and that publisher publishing that piece. But we're talking about sort of something quite different, which is this quite, you know, ongoing serious relationship between a composer and a publisher. So yeah, Oxford University Press picked up a few more pieces. And at that point, I think I had probably 10 or so pieces in print, all choral at this point. Mm-hmm. And also by that time, I had begun writing other varieties of music. I always had been, but these prizes, this publishing had led to more and more performances of the choral stuff, which had led to people getting interested in my chamber music. So this was sort of in the period from, as I said, I finished my degree in 99. We're talking about the next 5 years, from 99 to 2004, growing interest from other avenues, partly because of Oxford University Press picking up my music. And at that point, I realized that what I did want was a exclusive arrangement for the publisher. And the reason I wanted that is because those types of arrangement are ones whereby they tend to last for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's 3 years, sometimes it's 5 years. And in that period of time, you can't really go anywhere else. You know, you can't take your work anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But the agreement, if it's a fully exclusive agreement, is that the publisher publishes, you know, everything that you write. So you're sort of joined at the hip, in a sense, musically and financially. And I realized that because of the nature of pigeonholing in our business, that if I wanted the promotion and ability to get out into the world, the non-choral stuff, because already in those years I could see that if you're not careful, you can get pigeonholed very, very early, very quickly in one area. I needed this kind of arrangement. So it ended up being a choice between Novello and Oxford University Press, both great teams, both great publishing houses. But for me, at that time, Oxford University Press was still heavily choral-based. Mm-hmm. And Novello was part of a bigger organization, which is now called Wise Music. But it's, you know, the parent company is the parent of Chester Music, G. Shermer, Wilhelm Hansen, things like that. And these are, you know, a broad range of music making, also including media music and film music and things like that. So that's why I went with Novello in 2004 and have been there since.
To be as successful as you are, namely to be someone who makes their entire living from writing music, enough to afford to live in San Francisco, there must have been many important moments in your career. So from point A to point now, could you tell us about some of those key moments that you had prepared yourself for, specifically early on in your career?
You know, I mean, there are some, I would say, watershed moments that are going to be important, I think, for any composer. And then there are some things that are possibly more regionally important with regard to where you're living. So, you know, a big thing that happened was a first recording on CDs, when those existed, of pretty much most of my choral work to date. And that was really put together by Tim Brown, who was the director of music at Clare College in Cambridge, which is where I'd gone to do my postgraduate work. And actually, I owe a lot to John Rutter.
Really?
Because John Rutter, by that time, had started, or had always been doing this. He was always had been interested in recording and becoming a producer, in addition to composing. But he had really begun to focus that for his label, Collegium. And this was the label that put out my first CD, which was called Voices. Now, that was a watershed moment, because that CD got a huge amount of responses in the press, by which I mean some were very positive, some were negative, but the main thing is that, you know, it got noticed. And that type of thing changes your perception in the eyes of others, and it's very much to do with this, going back to this issue of vetting. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason in our business, people get very nervous of composers who are untried or untested, which I think is a fundamental problem with the business.
Really?
Which I can talk about. You know, I don't really, you know, one of the, you know, the fact that we still depend on people submitting CVs to composition competitions. Mm-hmm. I mean, that tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, shouldn't about it be?
Absolutely, yeah. And it tells you all you need to know about how little things have changed. And because I'm talking about 15 years ago,
yeah,
this idea of people being interested in your work because you've won a prize, which has led to a publisher, which has led to a bigger publisher, which has now led to a recording. It actually takes people like the John Rutters of this world to put in real belief in someone and commit to recording their work. So, you know, there are always going to be people in your life for which you're going to be very, very grateful for important moments that changed your career for the better. So that was certainly one. And then, you know, in the UK, I would say I was approached by the BBC and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra to write a piece for the Proms. And again, this was back when the Proms was regularly broadcast on television. Now, that's changed quite a lot. I mean, the classical concert world has receded, mm-hmm. and hasn't advanced in terms of public broadcasting. It makes it all the more harder these days. But, you know, again, the idea of having a piece broadcast on the Proms meant that your piece was sort of broadcast into people's homes on, mm-hmm. on TV. So again, that was about exposure to people that may not have ever heard of you. So these are sort of watershed moments that really are about to do with the expansion of your name and work in the career, in the field. And I think, you know, a lot of it is luck, but really a lot of it is the goodwill of people and the power of, you know, certain individuals that just want to make that leap of faith with regard to entrusting you to write music, or entrusting you to entrusting their own funds to record you, or direct commission funds. And, you know, more and more I've come to realize that at every single level of music making, it's about trust. You know, whether you're commissioning someone to write an opera, or whether you're playing in a string quartet and, you know, you're looking across to each other to make sure that you're together. These are really about trust. And so I think a lot of the music business comes down to that, and a lot of musicality comes down to it too. You should never forget how much goodwill there is in the world. It's very easy in our business to feel neglected. Yeah, and to feel there is, you know, some great conspiracy of corruption out there. Yeah. And certainly in any business, there will be nepotism and corruption and things like that. But fundamentally, you have to believe that most people are driven by good things in life and with a general sense of goodwill. And so I can definitely say that my life has benefited far more from the goodwill of people than it has been negatively impacted by any perceived slight or sense of corruption or nepotism that I somehow have convinced myself has come to work against me. And I think I would always encourage people to sort of stay on the positive side of that way of thinking.
That's something that I've learned a lot from these interviews that I've been conducting on this podcast, is that things are better out there than we might think. I mean, yeah, things are slow because of the pandemic and ensembles aren't rehearsing and all that. But I remember reading that someone said that we're getting ready for a new golden age of classical music because of the pandemic. Do you think that that's true? What do you think about the future?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think is going to happen is, because I think this period in which, you know, practical music making has stopped has also coincided with huge global conversations on historic imbalances and historic, you know, prejudices with regard to race, and also, you know, let's not forget historic imbalances in other ways, so especially with regard to gender.
Yes.
So I think what that has meant is not necessarily that there's suddenly going to be a whole bunch of new music being written that's amazing, but actually a re-examining of all the amazing music that has already been written is just been forgotten, or is just being ignored, or through institutional racism mm-hmm. has been deliberately ignored, and institutional misogyny has been deliberately ignored. But the thing about it, when, you know, I think the thing to think about that is greater equity is better for everyone.
Absolutely.
Because the level gets higher. If suddenly you're now looking at a much bigger pool of people, you're statistically going to have way better works out there that we can now revisit. So this is one of the great things that I think will happen, is as a sort of inflection point, and really, like, I think the classical music industry really should be having public, hard, difficult questions as to why black composers were ignored. Mm-hmm. Why, for the longest time, were women composers ignored?
And then that's compounded if they're a black woman composer.
Well, no, exactly. And, yeah. I think these discussions are not meant to be easy. They are hard, and really big institutions need to look at not so much quick fixes in terms of suddenly commissioning more diversely, which I think is absolutely the right thing to do, but it's somewhat separate to, I think, the bigger question is how come it took this massive global movement for you to notice that you haven't ever commissioned any black people, for example, or any composers of color, let's say, or why do female composers get paid less historically, or why has this happened? So I think those tough questions and that type of re-examining of the extant repertoire, the stuff that is already there that has been ignored, is going to be part of really a golden age of repertoire and new stuff that's going to happen. And I think that I'm quite excited about. But the one sort of thing I would say is that in the immediate future, whenever music making comes back, you have to be aware that there is now a buildup of commissioned work that has been premiered. So that, yes, there is going to be a vast amount of new stuff being, but that's all stuff that was, due to be premiered last year or so.
Right.
So I think a lot of performing ensembles are going to have their plates full premiering works that have already been commissioned, stuff that's in the can, in a sense. So I think that logistically will be, maybe quite hard, because there may be actually less commissioning going on in the immediate period.
Have a little bit of a traffic jam,
but
it looks like.
I think in terms of, exactly. But I think just the longer game, I think you're going to see that rapid glut of premieres of music that are sort of in the can. I sincerely hope a greater deep questioning of why these institutional biases have occurred, and a, not only a correction of that going forward, but also a re-examining, as I said, of repertoire that is already there, that you just need to work to find. So not only premiering greater, diversity of work, but also, this idea of looking back at extant work, but with a greater honesty, and not this pretense of discovery, which I find quite offensive, actually. Because what you're doing is you're suddenly claiming credit for having been institutionally biased for decades and centuries. Suddenly it's like, aren't I clever? I've just discovered this composer of color. Yeah, well, no, that's not how I would word it. I hope there are these sort of quite difficult, discussions that are happening. But what I'm trying to say is that the long game for these things to happen, these three things, glut of stuff that's in the bag being premiered, a proper re-examination of institutional biases, and a greater commitment to broader and diverse commissioning, which fundamentally all adds up to a greater relevancy and a greater presence of new music and contemporary music. I think for all of us is going to put the world in a much better place to be a composer in, personally. I think it's very exciting.
So as we're preparing for this this wonderful time that's going to come eventually, where the entire library of music will seemingly explode with new music, when really it's just doors are being unlocked, and so we're finally able to see works that have already happened, masterpieces that we've been blocked from hearing. What are some things that we can do, as specifically with your expertise as a composer, what are some things that composers can do right now while we're waiting for things to open up again, to help our career?
That really depends, I would say, on each individual's personal experience. So depending on your situation, if you I think there's a lot of pros and cons or discussions about quote unquote retraining and things like that. But I mean, in my mind, I don't see there being any problem or contradiction in, you know, if you're a composer at home and you don't have any commissions, you don't have any work, and there are no performances going on. The nice thing about composing in that environment is that, you know, there are you're not going to have any pressures of, you know, deadlines and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that you can keep doing while, you know, thinking about other, you know, avenues of work, whatever they may be. They may or may not be connected to the music business. But actually, I think those things go, you know, hand in hand. As I said, you know, I thought I was going to go and work in a bank or whatever. But it's, I think people can often feel that that's a sign of failure of some sense. And
almost like a betrayal of your calling.
Yeah. And all I want to say is I think that's an old way of thinking. I think one of the nice things about what I think is going to happen is a different way of thinking, which is that, you know, a lot of the problems that, you know, music institutions that are now dealing with biases, institutional biases, it's not even, you know, just the music that was programmed or commissioned, but it's also the entire way of thinking. You had to go up this route. You had to go from this school to this university. This needed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you needed to stay on this course. And if things get tough, you need to stay on the course. Because if you don't stay on the course, you're betraying the system, as you say. You're a failure. And, like, rewarding that kind of tenacity is completely part of the problematic system.
Right.
So if there is this honesty, if there is this institutional honesty at really revisiting why these biases have occurred, there should be an undoing of that entire one-track system. And I go back to this idea, you should not send a CV in with a composition competition. That needs to be eradicated. That way of thinking needs to be eradicated. Yet there is no point. I cannot see for one reason why, if we're really in this period where we're re-examining all of the things that have led to this deeply unequal way of living, why are we still asking for resumes or recommendation letters for a composition competition? It's completely pointless.
You don't need a pedigree to write good music or to have a piece be a smasher.
No, you're absolutely right. So I hope... And I say I hope, and that's my big, I think that's my big sort of, my big, you know, if, you know, with regard to this new period that's going to come, it's going to take proper introspection and proper change of that kind of change. Because then that kind of change allows you to say, you know what, I'm going to start a podcast. And I feel good about it. And it's great. And it's not going to impact my compositional career like you're doing. You know, and it shouldn't. It should just be something that's filling your time and your mental space. Hopefully, as you see, you know, something that will grow and will fuel you as a human being and fuel you as a composer. And that should be, you should have complete liberation in doing that. There shouldn't be 1 minute of your brain power spent, oh, if I do this podcast, does that mean that publicly I'm now going to look like someone that runs a podcast instead of being a composer? Yeah, you know, that way of thinking, that I hope goes with the old way. I really do. So that, my advice with regard to people, you know, right now is, you know, hold people, you know, to everything that people have said publicly over the last few months, whether they are statements about Black Lives Matter or whether they are statements about committing to commissioning new music in general, whether it's statements supporting contractors and freelancers and things like that. Hold people you know around yourself to that, because that is where the change is going to come. That is going to make things better for everybody. And I'm a real believer in, you know, hoping that does change things. And so, you know, if you can hold on to that way of thinking now during this difficult time, then really it's a very liberating moment. I think traditional forced choices where you would begin to worry about closing one door in order to open another, I think that whole way of thinking hopefully will have changed, and that actually you can hold both doors open. And in terms of repertoire and things to do, I mean, yeah, don't be one of these discoverers that's claimed to have, you know, pat yourself on the back, aren't I clever? Yeah, go and do the hard work. There are so many lists now that have been put out by broadcasters and orchestras and commissioners of music that's already there. Brilliant, fantastic music that's already been written. Overall, I'd say I'm pretty optimistic, but a lot of it, I think, is based on real change happening. And as I say, I think those changes, although they have been fueled by a collective re-examining of institutional racism, I think the impact of that on the field as a whole should be a radical change and a different way of thinking. And I think that that will be positive as well. I really do, for everyone.
Tarek, this has been absolutely phenomenal talking with you. And I think that any composer and or just musician in general is going to really love all this that you've had to say. I think it's going to be extremely helpful. So as we're sending off, what have you got in the works right now that you want us to get hyped up for?
So I am writing a saxophone concerto for a brilliant saxophonist called Amy Dixon. And this is a very interesting thing. It's for a wonderful festival called the Prestine Festival, which is on the sort of England-Wales border. When it looked like it wasn't going to happen, I thought, well, why? And Amy actually came up with this idea first, with an initial idea. It was like, why don't we do a little excerpt? And I thought, well, why don't I use the excuse of not being able to write a concerto for, in this case, it's for soprano, saxophone, and strings. You know, why don't I try and create a little solo piece from the material that is in the sort of in the concerto that I've already written for the concerto, and some ideas that are going to come further down the line. And so I wrote this sort of 2-3 minute piece called Machine, and she premiered that as part of their digital online festival. But it was a very interesting experience of, while you're in the middle of a piece, you know, stopping it because it's not going to get performed in the form it is, then going through what you've written in sketches and sort of refashioning them into some other thing. And then, of course, now that's made me rethink about how the rest of the piece is going to turn out. But all to say, you know, that sort of quite functional fiddling around with material and turning it into something else at short notice, I really like. It just reminds me of how, you know, composers are craftspeople. And like, I love that. I love that feeling of, you know, really digging in there and just getting away from, I will not touch my masterpiece. Mm. When the world is ready for it, it will be ready for it. I quite like that. So, you can find that online somewhere. And recently I've been working out here with Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, one of the great period instrument groups in the United States, with their new artistic director, Richard Egar. We've actually been having a sort of talk show while a lot of live music making can't happen, which is called What's New and Hip with Tarek and Rick. And we've interviewed some great people. We interviewed Roddy Williams recently, great performer and singer and composer, and just interviewed Errolyn Wallen, wonderful composer. Things are quite busy, and you know, a lot of recordings are coming out. So an album I did with Pacific Chorale came out, All Things Common. Just this week, my opera with Houston Grand Opera came out on Pentatone label. And then coming up is a big piece I wrote with the librettist Alice Goodman,
For Paul Hillier Chamber Choir Ireland and Irish Chamber Orchestra, that's coming out on Naxos, and that's paired with a great piece called Triptych by David Fennessy. It's a great composer. I think that album's called Letters.
So where can people go to learn more about you and your music?
You know, nowadays you can just find... I mean, honestly, I've got a website, tarikoregan.com, or my publisher is Novello, which is under the Wise Music category, or you can just search on Google or YouTube. There's whole bunches of stuff out there. I mean, one of the interesting things about composers is that you increasingly have less and less control with regard to how your music is, disseminated into the world. Mm-hmm. If you've got a Spotify account or Apple or Amazon, there's tons of albums out there with a broad range of stuff.
Tarik, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good luck with it. Very exciting.
Thank you for listening to Musical Progression with this week's guest, Tarik O'Regan. Musical Progression is sponsored in part by the Mike Merrill Composer Patreon page. If you're interested in helping this podcast continue and thrive, consider becoming a patron. There are plenty of perks waiting for all of our patrons, starting at just $1 per month. Find out more at patreon.com/Mike Merrill Composer, and happy music making.